How's everyone? Okay, I want you to stop for a moment and I want you to think about where your family, well, if you can think of this, where your family is originally from. And I want you to call it out. Ready? One, two, three. Did anybody say, I don't know? Yeah, and that's okay. That's okay. Tonight, what we're going to do is celebrate people's stories, which is really, really important. The stories are who we are. It's how we function. It's how we move and navigate through life. And it gives us a sense of what we can handle and what we can't handle. All those things are wrapped up in our stories. And I come from a culture that is steeped in tradition, the oral tradition. And it gives me a sense, now that everyone is gone, I'm the last standing survivor here in Portland, and it gives me a sense of who I am and what I can take, how far I can allow things to happen around me without becoming engaged, and why I engage. So there's a lot of information that you can garner from knowing a little bit more about your culture, okay? And then what it feels like when you're taken from your culture or you leave your culture and you try to become a part of a new one. So we're gonna have a little bit of a journey tonight, and I'm excited. Our speakers are wonderful, they're vibrant, and they're all so worried about whether or not they're going to be able to communicate the story to you, because their paths have changed along the way. So what they spoke about before, months before or a month before, may have changed in light of the things that are happening in our society today. So just sit back and relax. Give all of them a warm welcome and allow yourself just to listen. We Can Listen, Immigrant and Refugee Stories, are drawing on works created by Portland Story Theater's Urban Tellers series. This evening will feature real, firsthand stories of immigrants and refugees now living in Portland, Oregon. The stories told will address the othering, that's a word, othering, that has escalated in our country by humanizing and building connection within our urban community. The Old Church is grateful for the support of the Portland Story Theater through this collaboration, and we welcome back myself. I almost read my own welcome. And we welcome me. I'm Julianne Johnson, and I really enjoy working with the people who have put together this Week and Listen series. It's important because you have an opportunity to take this series into your own communities. So there are ways that you can talk to us about how you can set up a forum just like this and have a We Can Listen happen in your neighborhood. So see us afterward if you're interested, because we're making a list so that when we get to a chance of launching this experience, you may be a part of that, okay? The Old Church is grateful for the support of Portland Story Theater and tonight's storytellers in alphabetical order. And I'm going to ask you just to turn around and wave your hand, okay? This is an alphabetical order. Zara Abukar from Somalia. Fernando Lopez Garcia from Mexico. Philip Lund from Denmark. Lily Ningsi from Indonesia. And Ava Rotter Johnson from Venezuela. So first up, I want to tell you a little something about Lily. Lily is an Indonesian-born Chinese woman who loves to eat and cook and play a ukulele. You play? Really? Did you bring it tonight? Oh! So we're going to take a moment and have to get second half. You have to bring it. You have to bring it on stage. Please, please. It would be wonderful. A storyteller by accident, she says. Her story is an Indonesian story, and it's called The Voice. The Voice. She lived in Portland for 9 years and would love to go to Europe. And her favorite word is irascible. And she owned a motorcycle workshop in Indonesia. A motorcycle workshop. Go, girl. Yeah, you're doing great. So please welcome to the stage, Lily.
It was summer 2007. I was working at a big cafe in Arizona. And among all employees, I was the only Asian. One regular afternoon, not so busy, we just passed our rush hour. I was helping with a customer and two of my other coworkers, in order to fill up the time, they fold cookie boxes. Then I heard my manager call me. She said, "Lily, come here." And after I was done with the customer, I walked to her. She was standing next to a display case. Pointing at the case, she asked me, "What's that?" So I look at the case, everything seems fine. Yogurt stack fine, filled, oranges are fine, all filled. So everything was fine. But then I noticed something. I noticed fingerprints. So I looked at her and I answered, "Fingerprints?" And she said, "Wipe that off." I was a little bit confused. Like, why me? I was helping a customer and my two other coworkers, basically they're not doing anything. They're not doing anything. They're just folding the cookie boxes. So why me? Then I realized, oh my God, I know why me. Upon my realization, I started to feel my body tingling. My face getting warm. My chest is so heavy. And I was holding my tears. After the glass was spotless, I ran to the bathroom. And in there, I cried silently. I didn't come to America because I tried to escape poverty or war. I also didn't apply for the citizenship lottery. I came to America because of love. My husband and I met through online. And for the record, it was not through AsianWife.com. There's no such website, actually. So, at that time, I just ended an abusive relationship. I knew it was the right decision, but people around me seemed to blame me for leaving such a jerk of an ex-husband. My own best friend even said, "Lily, you are creating bad karma. Because you leave your ex-husband, you leave your husband and then take your daughter away." I knew getting divorced is the right thing to do. Yet, the world around me made me doubt myself. So I went to this Buddhist Yahoo Buddhist group to find these answers. What does Buddhism think about divorce? So I met this Bhutanese monk. His name is Sonam. And I asked him, what is it about this divorce thing? You know, what does Buddhism think? And he told me something like this. He said, divorce is just a piece of paper. But what truly a marriage is how you treat each other. If you can treat each other respectfully, kindly, compassionately, then you are creating good karma. But if you treat each other badly, then you are creating bad karma. As simple as that. So I like his answer. And I want to know more about Buddhism. Now, to let you know, Sonam's English and my English were on par. We basically chatted with the help of an online dictionary. And in order to help me better, he introduced me to this man. He speaks English so well. He has a degree in religious studies from Brown University. So he has such deep understanding about Buddhism, and he helped me all with my questions. And he is super cute. So this man is now my husband, and his name is Joshua. Yeah. I still adore him. So we got married in 2007, and that was the time where my struggle with English began. First, I couldn't get a good job without being looked down at. And I couldn't really make good friends because I was not confident. One day I tried to be confident, and then I was chatting with my neighbor, and I told her about a city in Arizona. And I told her, it's Tucson, Arizona. So, and she said, no, do you mean Tucson? No, it's Tucson. So my confidence has really kind of led to the wrong direction. So, and then it's kind of like discouraged me again, okay, don't say anything. And then with my husband, he is such a wonderful man. He loves discussion, super smart guy. And then he also wants to know how I feel and how I think. And he likes to engage in discussion or quote-unquote argument. So because my vocabulary, I don't have enough vocabulary to really express my thoughts. And I know that how to say that in English, but I couldn't really say that in English. I mean, I knew how to say that in Indonesian, but I couldn't say that in English. So mostly I lost the arguments. Losing arguments sucks. So you see how motivated I was to go back to school and learn English? And that opportunity came when I moved to Portland. I went to PC Pennsylvania, and I studied with ESL classes. And it was great. I love going back to school. In classroom, I learned great words. And one of my favorite words is irascible. I came home and said, don't talk to me. I'm being irascible right now. I also learn words from, like outside the classroom, from people's interaction with me. I learn words such as profiling or xenophobia. And I totally understand what that means. Despite that, I really had great time. Like I said, I love school. I love going back to school. So one year after another, ESL classes to next classes and to next classes, in such a short time, in 6.5 years, I graduated from Lewis and Clark with a bachelor degree in psychology and minor in art history. Now, along the journey of me learning English, I've met so many great people who have become my mentors. I was involved in such wonderful programs, such as Roots Program. And till today, I cannot thank them enough. But what's mostly important about my journey in learning English is that I really found my voice. I found myself. You see, in Indonesia, I'm fluent in Indonesian and Chinese, but I cannot really speak up. My opinions didn't matter because I'm a woman. But here, in America, in English, with all of my grammatical mistakes and my wonderful cute accent, I can voice out what I think and what I feel. Now, knowing what I know now, if somebody asks me to clean fingerprints again, while they are capable others, I'm going to ask them, why me?
She was so worried about starting, and I think you launched us right out on the runway. We're ready to go. Why me? Profiling and xenophobia. Those are good words for us. Good words to consider and how they apply, or if they apply. And if they don't, why do we allow them to apply in other people? Very interesting. Ava Rotter Johnson. It was really, I was excited to speak with you, even though we had to postpone it a couple of times, but we had a chance to really talk. And she attended the University of South Carolina, but originally she's from Venezuela. And her title of her story is Accidental Immigrant. Accidental Immigrant. She and her husband met in college, and she is a teacher and has been for 20 years in the Reynolds School District with a bilingual program. And I'm going to let her tell you the rest of the story because I have a kinship with this young woman because she and I are both teachers, and I understand how you feel about your students, and so I just want you to share.
All right. Thank you. So you know that feeling when you are a guest in someone else's house and you are kind of on pins and needles and you're kind of watching what your host is doing and you want to do the things that they do, you want to put the shoes where they put the shoes and you want to put the dishes away the way they want them? Well, the thing about being an immigrant is that you have that feeling with you all the time. You always feel like you are a guest in someone else's house. I have been an immigrant in this country almost 30 years, and I still have that feeling of I am in somebody else's home. Now, I titled my story Accidental Immigrant because I never meant to become an immigrant. I left my home country of Venezuela to come and get an education here in the United States. I wasn't taken from my country because of need. I chose to come here. But the plan was never to stay and become an immigrant. And in fact, the title of immigrant never really seemed to fit me. And I sort of stored it away for a long time. It's just recently with the political situation that I have revisit it, that label that I've given myself, or that society has given me. So let me tell you a little bit about my journey to immigrant status, so to speak. I was born in Venezuela. My parents were and are German. My dad passed away many years ago. But they chose to come to Venezuela in the 50s. At that point, my dad did not get a promotion that he was hoping for, and he was like, he was young and had started a family, and he was looking to do what was best for his growing family, so he chose to move to Venezuela. My mom had relatives there. Her parents were actually born in Venezuela. The connection with Germany goes back to colonial times. But in any case, they chose to go to Venezuela. My dad would have actually come to the United States. He, during the war, he got wounded right away. He joined the military towards the end of the war, and right away got shot by the Americans, and he was taken prisoner by them. And he almost died. His wound became gangrenous. But he was used as a test subject for a new drug. You might have heard of it, penicillin. So that saved his life, and therefore I'm here, so thank you. But in any case, so he had an affinity to the United States, but because my mom had relatives there, they decided to go to Venezuela instead. And I'm really thankful that they did, because A, I wouldn't have been trilingual if I had grown up in this country. I wouldn't have Spanish as it's my first language. And I don't know that I would have had German even, because I know that there were German immigrants that ended up not teaching their own kids their first language. So I am quite thankful that my journey started in Venezuela, not in the United States. But the love for the United States, I don't know if it came from my dad, but or more so because when I was growing up in Venezuela, anything cool came from the United States. Like, I grew up watching Hechizada and Mi Bella Genio, the show Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. I loved those shows as a little girl. And then a little bit older, when I was a teenager, I watched Los Angeles de Charlie and El Bote del Amor and, La Isla de la Fantasía. So Charlie's Angels, Love Boat, Fantasy Island, all of those shows. And I thought, oh my gosh, America is just too cool. So I decided to come to the U.S. I was lucky enough that my family could help me come study here, that was a choice. And I landed in South Carolina, the real USC, mind you. I am a Gamecock. Woohoo! And so people often ask me, why South Carolina? And at this point in my life, I kind of feel like it was fate. But then the reasons were quite practical. My sister was studying in Chicago at the time, and she said, don't come north, it's cold. And I said, okay. And South Carolina, the University of South Carolina, was advertising heavily in Venezuela, and so I started considering it. And at the time, you know, I didn't know that much about the U.S. I knew New York, and I knew California. I knew Florida. I knew I didn't want to go to Florida because I wanted to practice my English. I wanted to use the 5 years of English. There wasn't any of that in Florida. So I was like, okay, South Carolina, why not? Well, I got to South Carolina, and it was nothing like the movies or like the TV shows. But still, you know what? It worked out well. There were a lot of other Venezuelans there, so I was lucky not to feel super homesick. I had a group of people. I found out more about my own Venezuelanness through my friends. I learned how to dance salsa there. Growing up in Venezuela, I thought salsa was dumb. It's quite awesome. You should go learn it if you haven't yet. And the reason I think of it as destiny now is that I met my gringo while I was in South Carolina. I met my husband. Lily's story and mine are similar in that way because, yeah, I became an immigrant because of a man. And so my gringo happened to be from Oregon. And so when when he first told me, I was like, okay, I have no idea where that is. So he's like, California, above it. I was like, oh, yeah, okay. And now I've spent, almost all of my 30 years as an immigrant, I've spent here in Oregon, and I really, really love it here. So we eventually decided to start a family, and we decided we wanted to be around family, you know, extended family for that. And at that point, Venezuela was still pretty stable, but we chose to come to Oregon instead. My husband's family is all from here. And at that time, too, I got a job at the Reynolds School District teaching reading in a bilingual program. And many of the families that I work with are immigrant families. And so that was really nice because I immediately had a place where I didn't have to explain myself. You see, the thing about immigrants is that we always feel a little bit like we have to explain ourselves. And of course, I am the kind of immigrant that appearance-wise you wouldn't know that I am an immigrant, that I am other, but I am other and I feel it inside of me. And so with these immigrant families, it was a thing of beauty because the minute they started talking to me and we would talk about things in Spanish, that would disappear immediately. Like they would recognize me as akin, similar. And so I didn't feel like I always have felt in my life that I'm like in between, like I never know exactly where I belong. But this whole thing of being an immigrant, like I said, I kind of put it away for a while. It was just part of my story. And now, because of the way things are politically, I am dealing with it again. I'm revisiting that label. Lately, at the parent-teacher groups meetings that I go to, that I attend as a teacher rep, some of my families have been talking about coming up with an emergency plan. You know how you do for earthquake? They always tell you, like, oh, you have to have a plan and make sure you talk to your kids. Well, they're talking to their kids about what would happen if somebody gets picked up, if dad gets picked up by ICE, by the immigration, or if, you know, uncle, or if, God forbid, they do, if, you know. All these conversations, and it was just breaking my heart to hear this. Because I was thinking, what if that was me? What if somebody said, no, you have to go back to Venezuela? You probably have heard Venezuela is in shambles right now. And for me to go back there, I don't really belong there anymore. And so I totally put myself in their shoes of my immigrant families. And I think, what would that even be like? So the thing about immigrants is that what we want more than anything is to feel like we belong, like we contribute, like we are a part of this household that we call home.
Belong. And you're helping so many families belong too. The touchstone is to hear your language or to hear somebody or to watch somebody's eyes and see them connect with you because they see themselves in you. But it takes us getting together though, right? We have to do exactly what you're doing right now. So I'm going to ask you to just give a big applause for yourselves for being in this room at this moment. Don't hesitate. This is good. It's very good. For some people, it's a courageous step. For some, it is truly courageous because all of our families come from different places and have different cultures and believe different things. And our group that we hang around with believes certain things. And so for you to gather yourselves together and just want to hear, I think that's something that's missing right now, is that we just don't listen. We're always trying to plan what we're going to say while they're talking, right? You feel that? My millennials. You're my favorite people. You're just a little quirky. No, I love you guys so much. Thank you for being here. Thank you. Any more millennials in the room? Raise your hand if you are. Come on, be proud. Proud millennials stand. No, just kidding. I was one of you. I was one of those kids that was always in the room like a fly on the wall, you know, and I didn't realize how much I was learning along the way. And I just thought I was uncomfortable and I wanted to go get something to eat. But my grandparents and my parents would keep me in an environment that was full of knowledge and of truth and constantly growing and challenging. So those of you who are, how many grandparents are raising children right now? Anybody? Yeah. Yeah. So those of you who are raising kids, you know, drop them into these think tanks. Give them a chance to be exposed because their world is so different than the world that we all grew up in. And we just want them to be able to cope, to really cope. All right, our next person up, I just kind of like this guy. He's pretty cool. He's from Denmark. He gave his age right off the bat, because you know they're pretty pragmatic. It's just a matter of fact, this is who I am. So a 62-year-old Danish-American who works as a cardiac anesthesiologist at Kaiser. I've been in the U.S. for 20 years, over the last 40 years, and now Portland is my permanent home. And I've lived in Denmark 30 years and Sweden 10, married to Julie. That's a nice name. All right, come on up here. Your story, Philip's story, is Emergency One Game Changer.
Thank you. Hi, jeg hedder Philip Lund, og jeg vil gerne fortælle en historie. I'm Philip Lund, and I'd like to tell you a story. The year 1977 was a banner year for me. Kind of shocking. I had a child. I got married. I moved to the U.S. I was unemployed. And so there were things that needed to be taken care of, so to speak. I had started my life living in Denmark in a middle-class family. I had a good life. I went to school like everybody else did, and from age 12, I was pretty much on my own. The morality in Denmark is probably a little bit different than in the U.S. My parents didn't bother so much that I wasn't in with curfews because I was fairly responsible. And we would do things probably atypical for America here too. When I was 14, I bicycled from Copenhagen, where I grew up, down to central Germany, and then back again over a period of 3 weeks with a friend, and it would be like bicycling here from here to San Francisco and back again. And I doubt that a lot of American families would allow their son out on the road. So we went and saw the bars and the girls and the windows and all that stuff, and it was pretty innocent. A couple of years later, I traveled to England. I hitchhiked around for 6 weeks, 1 year, and 8 weeks, I'm sorry, another year. And so I kind of had a very free-spirited life and enjoyed myself. Unfortunately, that sort of reflected in my schoolwork. probably wasn't so good at school. It was a little bit too much partying. In high school, from age 16 to 19, we would have beer parties at the school with this the teachers as chaperones. So you would have I think I was part of the organizing committee, and we would buy 1,800 beers for 500 students, you know? So the morals were a little bit different, but we didn't have driver's licenses and no cars, so I guess it was safer that way. But again, so when I was 16, my parents decided, well, you know, I probably was a little bit too wild, so maybe I should get out of school because I wasn't doing very well and get a trade to become an electrician. And I kind of revolted. No, I want to be back in school, and I tried better. And I ended up finishing getting into high school. In order to go to high school in Denmark, you have to show aptitude. And I had absolutely no aptitude for the sciences and questionable aptitude for languages. But they gave me a break. And okay, we'll allow you in high school. And I ended up finishing high school on time, but with a very sort of cliffhanger, you know, not very good, C minus. But I got a high school diploma, which really turned out to be a key event in my life. Much later on, I had good use for that. Even though the grades weren't that great, it still helped me. And after that high school, I took a year off, a gap year, where I traveled to Canada with a friend, and we hitchhiked around for 3 months. So I've probably seen more of Canada than most Canadians. It was a wonderful country with a lot of pine trees there. A lot of pine trees and a lot of corn, but it was a beautiful place. And then coming back, I went to an associate's degree program to learn Spanish and English translation for business purposes. And since my high school had been so poor, I decided to pick a language I'd never been exposed to before, so I could sort of give it another shot. And I went through this two-year program, and I did pretty okay. It was not C minus, it was probably a little higher than that. But during that time, I met a lovely woman from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and we decided to be a couple. And in some way, I'm not really sure, she turned out pregnant. And the result of that is now a 40-year-old woman who lives in Olympia. And she's not here tonight, but she was here the first time I gave the talk. So in order for us to have a relationship, either she would have to move to Denmark or I would have to move to the U.S. And for practical reasons that she was still in school and I had sort of a break, we decided for me to come to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which is sort of up in the northern woods, you know, not much to do there, a lot of guns and deer and that kind of stuff, but it was a nice place. I really kind of enjoyed it. But now being faced with a new marriage, a newborn who was crying and screaming, no job, I realized, oh my God, I got to do something about this. So I tried to get a job as an auto parts salesman, but they wouldn't have me. And then I wanted to be a paralegal because I had worked with languages and legal stuff during my undergraduate time, and no, they wouldn't have me either. So I got a job in a nursing home feeding, cleaning old people, and that got old pretty quickly. And across the street was a was a hospital, and I'd been watching this TV show called Emergency One, where Roy and John, they saved lives in the streets of Los Angeles, taking these poor patients to Rampart Hospital, and I thought, that sounds pretty interesting, so maybe I should be doing that, you know. So I applied for a job in the emergency room, sort of an open application, and they decided after 6 weeks, hey, we'll interview this guy. And I went for the interview, and I got the job, and it was great because at the nursing home, I'd only been making $2.90 an hour for 6 hours because they were trying to save money. And now at the emergency room, it's $3.10 an hour and full time. So it was, you know, a significant amount of money for us. And I know gas was only 52 cents a gallon and rent was $125 a month. But still, you know, we needed some cash to live. So I started this job, and I was introduced and learning the ropes. And after a couple of weeks, the head nurse called me in and said, hey, Philip, now it's time for you to start your night rotation or your night job. See, I'd been hired into the night position, and I had no clue. You know, can you really work at night or on the weekends? But it turned out to be the best thing ever, because in the daytime, there were a lot of people there, and as an orderly, you didn't get to do much in sort of very menial jobs. But at night, we were only four people, two nursing assistants and a nurse and then the physician. And the other nursing assistant, she loved to be in the back room cleaning up stuff. So I got to do all this patient care. And I did a lot of practice outside the scope of my practice or whatever it's called, you know, like kind of doing things that you shouldn't be doing. But nobody died and everybody was happy. So it was kind of inspiring, you know, and I thought to myself, maybe I shouldn't be just pushing carts and doing this kind of work. Maybe I should do something else. And I decided then, well, why don't I just wipe the slate clean, start from scratch. Remember, I had been ineligible for natural sciences in high school. If I wipe the slate clean, don't drink a lot of beer, just go to school, do algebra 101 first, and I passed and I got an A. I thought, wow, I can do this. So I did algebra 102 and I passed that with an A as well. And I got kind of smitten, you know, it's like, wow, I can do this. And then I decided, I want to go to medical school. And I knew that the project was 15 years ahead, but it became easy in its difficulty because I had a goal that was very easy to achieve if you took it semester by semester. It would be a lot of work, expensive and difficult, and a lot of toll on the family, but it was a big change from what I had started out with my academics. So I gave it a go, and I eventually ended up getting a medical degree. So when I think about my immigration to the U.S., that I came here for love, just like Lily, that what really happened to me was that being put outside one's zone of comfort and getting pushed into a corner with this situation being in northern Wisconsin made me reshape my life, and I'm very thankful for the opportunity to wipe the slate clean and plot a new course.
Thank you. Thank you. You were a rogue. That's what you were. Live life to the fullest, yes? Yes, very good though. Thank you for sharing your story with us, because he had his tenacity about him, you know, that when he made a decision. But that's what our country does for people who don't have the opportunity or don't use the opportunity well. We have so many ways that we can encourage people to be successful. And I just hope we don't mess up that opportunity to reach out to each other. I have hope that we're not going to do that. I think we're going to do a good job, but we just have to make sure that we see the purpose of Lady Liberty. When it says, give me your tired and your poor, and your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores, right? We have beautiful, majestic words that greet people as they come to us. And our words are beginning not to mean anything. We have to get our language back. We have to bring ourselves back to neutral and start again, restart. It's very good. Fernando Lopez Garcia had such a great opportunity to speak with him, because we have like minds, we have some similar things that have happened in our lives, and I just think you need to tell it from the beginning to the end, and let us ride along with you, because you really touched my heart. Come, come. Mm-hmm. The name of his story is Moving On.
Todos venimos de algún lugar. We all come from somewhere. When I was 20 years old, I found myself in a predicament. I was 20 years old then. I was fighting with my dad a lot. I was being a teenager. I lost my job, I left school, and my girlfriend at that time, she ended the relationship. So I had nothing else or anything to do, so I left. My dad told me, if you don't like the rules of my house, you can go. So I packed my bags and left. So I came to the States. I called my dad and said, I want to go. So I start a new life. I didn't speak any English then. So I worked in restaurants, did dishes. I learned how to cook. I became a driver. It was quite interesting. And it allowed me to appreciate life in a different manner. Because back at home, you have everything. But when you are away, you learn to appreciate every single thing your parents and your siblings do for you. So then in Philadelphia, when I moved, I met my wife, and she wanted to move to Portland because her sister lived here, and she wanted kids to have family close by. And that was a good idea, so we did. I've been here for about 10 years now, a little over 10 years. Now I have two kids, 10. My daughter is 10, and my son is 8. And I found myself with a new city, with a new beginning, and it was great. I stayed home that for about 8 years. It was actually quite interesting because it made me appreciate how much my mom has done, and every mom. Being at home is a lot of work. Yeah. When she will see me all stressed out, she will say, why don't you go to the basement and take a break? I'm like, I don't want to go down there. There's laundry to be done. I don't want you. So there's always a lot to do there. But I enjoy it. I really enjoy it. We had a house, and we had everything going on for us. Kids went to school and running errands and schedules and doing everything that I could, the best that I could. But then, just last year, life changed. It started in February when my sister gave me, she called me and she said, you need to come home. Dad's in the hospital. I said, okay. She called me Sunday, and on Monday I was down there in Mexico. When I got there, I went straight to the hospital. What they didn't tell me, though, is that my dad was in a coma. It was hard for me to see my dad laying down in bed. He was not the same guy. Always strong, always fair, always a good man. So I stayed in the hospital with them for about 2 weeks, and he was improving little by little. At some point, he was moved to the ICU, and I got to stay a couple nights with him. One of those nights, he had pneumonia, so he was in sedatives, and he had a tube down his throat so he can actually not choke with his fluids. So one night, he almost died there, and I was there. I may be so afraid, but I had faith, and I thought it's going to be okay. Then, to my surprise, the next morning, he wakes up, and he sees me just the way I see you. He smiles. He cannot tell me anything. I hold his hand, and he squeezes it, just like he always done. He looks at me. He nods at me. Just like saying, son, it's going to be okay. And I'm very happy about it. I'm beside myself. I cannot say anything, but just look at him and say, so we're going to be this thing or what? I got a cell phone that they left with me. I call my sister, my nephew, and say, you know what? Big mom, because dad woke up. She comes to the hospital. She and I switch places, and I go to the house to get a shower and get something to eat. And while I'm there, we get a phone call. is my sister, and I can hear from the other room. She's talking to my nephew and tells him, tell your uncle not to shower and please come back to the hospital. That just died. I remember that moment just like yesterday, and I carry it with me every day. I remember shaking. And all I could do just fall to my knees and start crying, asking why. I took a moment to gather myself, we went to the hospital, and it was hard to see my dad laying down lifeless. The man that carried me throughout all those years and told me everything I knew. I came back home to Portland. Can't wait to see my kids. I remember the feeling of seeing my dad. And when I came back home, I remember something he told me once before. Whenever I'm gone, if you have the need to tell me something beautiful, or to give me a hug, or tell me that you love me, give it to your son. I will receive it, wherever I might be. So I did. And my son and my daughter, when I came home, they were so sweet, so supportive. Then, almost a month, my brother dies. He was just too sad. I was talking to him through text that night that he was too sad. He was drinking, he was happy, he was upset. He had all sorts of emotions, and he couldn't bear feeling so sad about dad dying. He found himself, he found his way to some potions, and he drank it. It was hard. Being away from my family for so many years, 12 years, in fact, I didn't see them. And then they're gone. Not just that, after my brother died, then about a month after that, my marriage ended. It was too much to bear. See, I discovered that when we go through a lot of pain, and in spite of that, we found ourselves. I found my heart being clear of all the things that was blocking me from growing. I did my share of crying, drinking, not sleeping, not caring for myself. But I was very lucky because I have met a lot of people, good people, strangers on the street just saying, hey, how you doing? And having that connection, a lot of good friends. I met a special someone that is here with me tonight. And through this process, I met Lois and Lynn that gave us the first class to do this. I never thought about this, talking to people in front of strangers. It's hard. But here I am, and I'm glad I'm doing that. So thank you for that, everybody. With that said, all the pain and all the suffering that I went through last year allowed me to think about my dreams. It also, not just being very humbling year for me, but also it taught me how resilient, how strong one can be. See, I learned that we cannot control the things that happen to us, but we can control how we react to those things. How can we move forward? So now I'm moving on because my kids depend on that. They depend on me. I depend on myself. I always say that Alicia, my daughter, she's my heart. My son, Alberto, is my blood. Andre used to be my force and drive in life. Now I am my own force. And I'm glad in a way that everything that has happened, because he brought me back to who I am. and allowing myself knowing that there is always someone out there that struggles the same way or worse than you, and allow me to reach out and say, you know what? What can I do for you today? Because that's more important than saying, it's me. You can. I could have a chance to play the victim or move out of that. And I am moving on. So I took my placement test for college a couple of weeks ago. So I'm going back to school, which is great. I mentioned that I was a stay-home dad, so I didn't go to school. I just got my GED 2 years ago, and I want to do it, so I'm going to do that. Yeah. Along the way, I learned trades. I'm a welder. My dad was a welder. I know carpentry. I cook. I do a lot of things.
You make good salsa.
I make salsa as well. And thank you. I always say that there's two things I don't do. I don't dance, speak Russian, or bake. Nothing else. And in spite of everything that has happened, I keep learning, and I keep moving on. I feel great about the things, the new beginnings that I got. But I know in my heart that if I had to go through all this again, just as the same, I'll be happy to. Because I will have my kids, my Alicia and my Alberto.
I want to meet the kids. Don't you want to meet his children? They're pretty awesome. Awesome. All right, Missy. The beautiful, the talented, the ever effervescent. I'm just making all this up, but you look like that. Zara Abukar has a Somalia story. And she says, I am more than the pieces of my identity. I am more. She's a Somalian American immigrant who lived in Oregon for 9 years. Zara graduated from PSU with a degree in public health and is currently attending Lewis and Clark to become a mental health counselor. Zara Abukar.
Oh, I love you. Lots of good stuff. Oh my God, I'm amazed by your stories. Oh my goodness. I was born and raised in Mogadishu, Somalia. For some of you who do not know, that's in Africa, by the way. I am very challenged geographically, so I can't tell you where. I don't know if it's in the east, west, whatever it is. It's up there somewhere. I grew up. Come from a large family. I'm second to youngest of 11. And my identity has always been tied to my siblings. I was always somebody's sister. I was only 5 when the war broke in Somalia. I don't remember much about it. I don't remember much about the atrocities that took place. And I thank my mom for that. She had tried her best to shield us from that. Even though she had seen people die in the day, she would come home and tell us stories. She would act as if nothing had happened, even though we were hearing the bullets. She would come home and tell us good stories. She would make us imagine better days and better times. But I do remember one thing. I remember we moved constantly. In fact, I never had a hometown, a place to call home. We moved about over a dozen times before we made our final move and the biggest move of our lives to the U.S. 15 years ago. See, before coming here, I didn't really study or research America. I've heard good things. So, given that I've moved a lot, that constant move, I was a pro at adjusting to new environments. So, we landed in Atlanta, Georgia. And it was easy adjustment. Except I was having a hard time about some discoveries I was making. See, like Ava, she had some ideas of what America is. I had no idea. So as I was sitting in my history class, for the first time in my life, I heard about slavery and racism and discrimination. It was hard to digest. I was shattered. It was hard to process. I was hearing terms and names that I never imagined. I was hearing discrimination, civil rights, Rosa Parks, MLK, and KKK. I'm like, cool. How do I process this? In short 1 hour class, twice a week. See, most of the other students knew about this, so they're like, what's wrong with you? Why are you all red? The 17-year-old me was like, whoa, I thought we had it bad in Somalia. Shit happened here. Sorry, I promise not to drop any of that. I was having a really, really hard time processing this, and I had no support. I was going home, and I would talk to my parents about it. I'm like, did you know this stuff happened here? And they're like, no. I was like, we came here for refuge. We came here running away from bad stuff, but bad stuff happened here. I was so desperate to understand where things were now, because I was afraid. It's like, so is this over or is still going on? Are people still being segregated? What is happening? I really had no idea where things stood. So I did look forward to history class, but I always left traumatized. More importantly, what was important to me, I was very self-absorbent. I wanted to know where I fit in all of this. Was I safe? How were things gonna fare for me in my future? And I learned that the hard way. Before I was even here for a year, I stopped counting how many racism encounters I've had. Not that I was forgetting about them. They stayed in my memory, but I lost count. In Shelbyville, Tennessee, a man finally shouted at me, go back to Africa. Go back to where you came from. And many other angry drivers have told me to go back to Africa. Not that it had anything to do with my bad driving. I know I'm a bad driver. But Africa, it's not its fault. But then I remember the college professors who had told me, when asked for clarification, I don't teach English in this classroom, I teach science or math. Reminding me that English is not my native language. And my favorite one, if it's so bad here, Why don't you go back to where you came from? And that has been on my mind lately. I've been thinking about that. And I've been reflecting on that. If it's so bad here, why don't I go back to where I came from? Well, first of all, when I became a naturalized citizen, they made me give up my Somali nationality, so I have nowhere to go back to. I go to the 4 a.m. line when I visit Somalia. I'm a foreigner. But when I think about it, I've been reflecting on this. I think about the day my 9-year-old came home in tears, panicking. She was born in Nashville, Tennessee, by the way. She's as American as anybody gets. But another child, another nine-year-old told her that if Trump was elected, that they were going to hurt us. She really was scared, for real. And I was outraged. But then I reflect on the current toxic political climate that we're in that has put a target on my back as a Muslim woman who wears her identity so visibly. I walk out the door taking risks every day. And I think about all the other women who do the same. I'm usually not afraid for myself. I think about all the other women who wear their identity so bravely, who some of our leaders have recklessly put a target on their back. Yet, I'm asked the question when I challenge that narrative, when I say, hey, that's terrible, I'm asked, why don't you go back to where you came from if it's so bad here? I think about that. Do I have to choose between two bad choices? Either I'm safe here, or either I'm not safe here or not safe in Somalia, which is the reflection I've been having. I've been telling you that I'm having a really hard time processing this. I'm really having a hard time with my faith in humanity, that when people stand up to injustice, when people stand up to injustice, we tell them, if it's so bad here, go back to where it's worse. Like I said, as I ask myself, how are things now in that history class? How are things? How do I fare now? Is this over? Is it still ongoing? That question I've asked myself, that I've been so worried about, that I've been trying so desperately to find answers to. What is the status of racism in this country? And as I come to terms with the painful truth that it still overshadows us, I find hope in my ability, whether people like it or not, whether I'm immigrant or not, that I can fight back, and that injustice is injustice no matter where I came from, and that I have the right to fight back, and I am going to fight back, and nobody's gonna stop me.
Question, the first thing that you thought or felt when she walked up in her native garb. This is what I wore today. Seems like it's super casual. casual for me, but this isn't a casual statement. And it says transparency, but I want you to do that within yourself. This is not about pointing a finger at anybody. This is about us purging our own stuff based on what we hear and what we can feel emotionally from the people who are talking to you. There's a reason why there's so many ethnicities represented here. We didn't take the easy way out. We didn't just show you a bunch of black people mad at you. We could have. But we're so desensitized, right? It's just something that, they're going to talk about civil rights and the movement. And, okay. We don't even call him Martin Luther King anymore. He's MLK. Mickey. Dr. Mickey. Yes. But what I'm asking you right now is for us to process. Yeah. This is not a time for us to feel put upon or anything like that. We need to just process. And we're going to do it all together. So the processing together is going to happen in the reception hall. You're going to get a chance to ask any question that popped up in your mind that you wanted to ask them while they were speaking, or you considered, or some of your situations and your stories that you can share. This is the time, okay? And we're just going to be one big old dysfunctional family. Which is really what we are. We're just a big old dysfunctional family, that's all. You know, and we're going to be all each other's brothers and sisters and go back in there. And in all of our dysfunction, we're going to do it with love, and we're going to ask the questions that have always been burning in your heart, or give some love and some congratulations too. Okay? And we'll do that for about how many minutes? 10 to 15 minutes, and then we're going to come back and we're going to put the panel all up on stage, and I'm going to ask them some questions, and we'll see what the responses actually are. Okay? Is this worth your time? Is it? Okay. Show the old church how much this is worth your time. Go in and have a nice time, and we'll see you in just about 15 minutes. Okay.